welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Jackson McKenzie, who is the author of Psychopath Free, Recovering from Emotionally Abusive Relationships with Narcissists, Sociopaths, and Other Toxic People. This is a very interesting book, one that delves into the, the practices and patterns that psychopaths use to draw people in, to maintain the relationship as long as it is satisfying to the psychopath, and then how they systematically destroy the relationship while trying to destroy the person. And Jackson has created a program with steps and explanations and things that you can do to recover from this situation. And we're going to talk about that right now. Thanks for joining us, Jackson.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So you had written this book out of a personal experience, and I assume that you were able to find others who had similar experiences. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, before I even wrote the book, I was just kind of in some online communities talking with friends, trying to figure out what had happened, and we ended up starting the community psychopathfree.com long before the book was even released.
So I guess we can start out with a definition of a psychopath and how it differs from, say, something like a sociopath or a narcissistic personality.
Yeah, sure. So first off, I'd just like full upfront, I don't have like any psychological or medical credentials. What I do is purely just based off of an experience and the experience of other people that I've worked with for the past 2 years. And because of that, I really try not to dive too much into the differences between the different diagnoses, because I don't think I'm qualified to do that. But I do know the impact that these disorders have on others, and it's a constant pattern of harm, and they all follow a very similar pattern, which is the idolization, devaluation, and an eventual discard. So all people in these cluster B disorders, so psychopaths, sociopaths, narcissists, they're social predators. Essentially, there's no conscience there. They don't feel remorse and guilt where you or I would normally feel bad when we cause harm to someone else. There's nothing there. Sometimes there's even an enjoyment of that. And because that conscience isn't there, they're able to use an incredible amount of charm and manipulation to get what they want out of others. And that could be anything from families, friendships, relationships, even like cults in the workplace. These patterns of behavior are very, very consistent with them. They draw in others with flattery that's very heavily based off of your own needs, wants, insecurities. Everyone has them, and it doesn't make anything wrong with a person that ends up in one of these dynamics, but they do target those qualities in you so that you feel extremely open and safe and secure, and then slowly start to erode those things in you so that your identity becomes a bit of a mess.
So you talked in a little bit of detail about how there's three phases. The first phase is the idealization phase. Is that how you pronounce it? Or
yeah. So the idealization is kind of like when you first encounter a sociopath, a narcissist, a psychopath, it all starts out the same. It's essentially like you're the only person in the world. You are the most incredible person they've ever known. They're completely focused on you, like in every single way, and everything that you do is perfect and flawless. And so that's the idolization. It's just that you are better than everyone from their past, whether it's a workplace or crazy bosses or a relationship, their crazy exes. You'll just constantly hear these flattery and these comparisons to these other people that never lived up to how amazing you were and how lucky they are that they've found someone just like you.
And so in this phase, they're kind of playing to your sense of being special and being very similar to them. Is that right?
Yeah, it's mainly they're trying to show that they're similar to you.
Okay.
And it's called, it's a lot of personality mirroring. Some people call it a chameleon-like quality. When they have their sights set on you, they become almost like this strange, like, twin version of you that it also fills in a lot of maybe voids or insecurities you might have, too. But the thing that confuses and baffles so many people, which is what leads them to this topic, is how they seem to become a completely different human being when they move on to the next person. And that's because it's that personality mirroring going on.
So let's talk a little bit about personality mirroring. Mirroring is a term that comes out of NLP. You mirror somebody to draw them in, you know, to establish things that are in common. It's a sales technique, actually. So
yeah.
When you mirror somebody, they think that you're similar to them and therefore more likable and more trustable trustworthy and that type of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a great analogy of, like, bringing that up. There's also, like, politics, and it's just finding ways to relate to people and make them like you. And in relationships, a lot of that is about just, we have so much in common. Wow, I can't believe how perfect we are for each other. It's a lot of words over not necessarily actions. Maybe in the beginning there will be gifts and flattery and things like that, but that'll drop off pretty quick.
So when they're mirroring the other person, that one of the clues is that it's words and not actions, like that it's just something that is, more superficial. Is that right?
That's a perfect word for it. It's that superficial praise and flattery that you'll come to get this sense that it's not authentic, which is how so many of these relationships, workplace things end up imploding with a sociopath or a narcissist, is that eventually the person that they are targeting starts to not like the behavior that's going on because it's not matching up with the words. And a lot of that creates an intense amount of confusion. It's, some people call it gaslighting, cognitive dissonance, those kind of things. It's this sense that what this person is saying to you, that you're so perfect and amazing, and all of this stuff is not matching up at all with the behaviors that are coming out.
I actually looked up the phrase gaslighting the other day because it was in a medical report and I didn't know what it meant. And it actually means, like, trying to convince the person that they're crazy.
Yeah, and it comes from a movie, actually, called Gaslight, and I think it was a great example of it. Basically, this guy had a woman in his house and was essentially keeping her captive in her own head. Every time he would leave, he would flicker the lights, and she would point that out, and he would tell her that that wasn't happening. And the goal of gaslighting is to just completely erode your sense of intuition and sanity, and, like, what makes sense and what doesn't. And so people in the cluster B spectrum are constantly telling you that the things that you are perceiving and noticing are not happening, and that there is something, if they don't say it explicitly, that you're crazy, which you'll frequently hear, but if they don't say that, the implication is there. And there's a lot of that patronizing kind of superiority that starts to come along, of, like, you just feeling like a lunatic and them kind of judgmentally watching over you.
So this first phase then gradually becomes, starts to change, and the change is sort of the criticisms start coming in, you go ahead and explain how that changes, it's subtle at first, but then it becomes more frequent.
Yeah, sure. So I think a lot of people who encounter these relationships and dynamics would describe themselves as pretty easygoing people, flexible, all these things. And what starts to happen here is that they're kind of, like, testing those boundaries and pushing them further and further and further,
mm-hmm.
To the point where it starts out with little things that just might bug you, like a little snide comment about, like, maybe the way you look or, like, your friends or something like that, or just little things that are very hard to pinpoint without seeming very petty. Some of these are some pretty common tactics. So triangulation is a really big one that we talk about and people deal with a lot, which is, after all of this flattery and love bombing about how wonderful you are and how awful all these other people are, most people will tell you the best indicator of current behavior is the past behavior. And so, yes, while that person was telling you all of those things, you will soon become that person who was the person who harmed them and the abuser and the thing that, you know, was causing all these problems. And they're meanwhile going and starting to idolize and flatter these other people. So what that does is it gives this really strong sense of complete instability and confusion. And that's like it's a way of eroding someone's boundaries without explicitly saying, you know, any sort of verbal abuse. There's no insult there. There's no criticism of you or your life or anything like that. But there's a very clear message that comes from starting to dangle other people in your face and go back to people that were once described as crazy or jealous or whatever, and treating them better than they treated you. And the message there is that you don't matter. You're not important.
Okay. And then what are some of the other things that then occur after that, after the subtle insults or criticisms?
So as that starts to happen, I think one of the common trends, like if you check out books written by people diagnosed with these disorders, one of them is Confessions of a Sociopath. There's this constant sense of pervasive boredom that psychopaths deal with. Is so, yes, they've convinced themselves or you that they've found this amazing person and then all that happens, but then this boredom kicks in and it's always there. It's that high, that excitement of being with someone is not there, and then the excitement kind of comes around watching this person scurry around for them, compete for them, want them, desire them, be confused, because any normal human being is going to assume that every other person has a conscience, and we're going to try to rationalize things from that perspective. It's the only thing that makes sense. So you think to yourself, oh, this person's doing this because they're insecure, or they're doing this because it's a total mistake, because no one would ever do that. And so it really starts to happen when these dynamics start to come crumbling down, is this total erosion of your own sense of self. There's a lot of silent treatment is really common. So anytime you behave in a way that's out of line or unacceptable, you're met with silence. And the message there is just, this will end at any time if you continue misbehaving. And misbehaving essentially meaning noticing that something's wrong and standing up for yourself. There's lots of, you're overanalyzing everything. I hate drama. You're too sensitive. You're hypersensitive. All of those things, because essentially, all of those parts of you that are suddenly feeling sensitive when you've never felt so sensitive before, you're feeling like there's drama all the time, but you don't feel that you're the one who's creating it, and they keep saying they hate drama. It's like, it's this very crazy-making confusion whirlwind of what in the world is going on, and what happens and why so many people end up finding our site and stuff is that the person who's going through all of this, the target of the emotional abuse, comes to think that they are the bad one, that there's something inherently wrong with them, that they are doing things to deserve this, and that they don't have worth, they don't have value, and that's where that switch really starts to happen.
Yeah, going back to this falling in love, chemically, it usually lasts about 3 months. So I would imagine that a lot of the psychopath relationships last about 3 months in that intense phase. But if the psychopath really does not have a connection to their conscience or their soul or, you know, any spiritual nature that is in good spiritual nature, because they might be in contact with something else, definitely, it seems to me that at about the three-month mark, that might be the time that it often switches to the more subtle comments and the the warnings. You talk about the warnings in here, you know, like they give you warnings that if you behave in a certain way, not if you behave in a certain way, but if somebody behaves in a certain way, that's why they dropped them in the past, kind of warning you that you should not do that.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. And I never knew that the scientific three-month love thing, but I can see through that it's very accurate. So, yeah, once it's out of that, and once you're out of that phase of everything is so wonderful and perfect, is, yeah, you still have love, but then you also have, we all as human beings desire, like, actual emotional connection with people and, like, bonding and building relationships and connections. And
that
is not what someone with a cluster B wants. That they want, you know,
well, they
the idolization.
I think they can't do it. I mean,
exactly.
I think that it's just
possible.
Yeah. It, you know, the, like you said, they're devoid of that spiritual connection. So once it, and it's truly an endorphin thing for 3 months. That's that high feeling, and they get it too. I mean, the sociopaths get the high feeling, but then they get, when it goes over, then they're bored. You know, that the boredom sets in, and they have to, they really have to seek out somebody else. Because it has to be another person to generate that endorphin rush.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they can't repeat it, so it's kind of interesting. So they go through this period where they, like, don't call or ignore you, or then when you call them, they accuse you of being needy.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that's, this is like going from, you know, in the beginning of the relationship, they'll be texting you on like a minute-by-minute basis, calling, where are you, all this stuff that converts into they will not acknowledge your existence for a day or two at a time. And like you said, when you point that out or want to have the connection with your partner, you're needy, you're crazy, you're jealous, you're all of these things, and you start to believe that. And that's really the, I think, the most devastating part towards the end of the relationship, is that you really start to absorb those messages as the truth.
So then at the end of the relationship, let's talk about that a little bit. What are the things that kind of naturally happen? And then what are the things that in your book you recommend the person do to get free of the emotional abuse and the, you know, and the feelings of not being worthy and stuff like that?
Yeah, so the end of the relationship is usually, it's extremely insensitive, and will feel like, I can't even really explain, it just will feel like one of the most callous, like, thoughtless things ever. And typically, once your relationship is ending, they've already more than lined up a different relationship. Which you may have sensed and pointed out, and they call you crazy and maybe accuse you of cheating instead. But what you'll see is, if you are not the one that leaves your partner, which is not all that common in these, because the victim is often so linked to those strong feelings of love. But if you are not the one that breaks things off, they'll simply just leave you. Sometimes it's with complete silence, like never acknowledging your existence, and go on to the next relationship. And this is what almost every target sees, is this person moving on the next day and or that week, and not even just moving on. It's like a sense of, you see them doing what just happened with you, except this even seems better. And they're, you know, where any normal person would feel kind of like guilty or bad about having cheated on you for like a month or two or something like that, and not doing anything and not telling you that, they'll be plastering their new relationship all over Facebook, making sure that you see it. I mean, that's half the fun, is, okay, now I have this new person who can be jealous and feel devastated and sad. And so that's really where a lot of people end up, is just this feeling of how can they be so happy with someone else when we were perfect for each other?
Right, right. So, well, let's talk a little bit about the, I guess, the personality traits of a sociopath and how you might be able to identify them before you fall in love with them. How's that?
Yeah.
That might be, prevention might be a little bit easier than the cure afterwards.
Yeah. I definitely think a lot easier.
Right. So essentially, I am a medical doctor, so I do have psychiatric training. So a narcissist is somebody who really sees the entire world just from their point of view. I mean, it's just a viewpoint thing, a filter. So they are not capable of empathy or compassion, but only because they are narcissistic. Not because they probably do have more spiritual connections, but their filters are so ego-based that they can't see anything other than through their own personality. That's what I would say a narcissist is. Plus, they have an elevated opinion of themselves. They think they're better than other people in most ways. So that's a narcissist. And there's plenty of narcissists out there. I mean, we all know them. They it comes from, I think, the Greek god of Narcissus, who spent all the time looking in the pool at his own reflection. So that's what that's based on. But that's like a smaller category. I don't consider narcissists as dangerous as psychopaths and sociopaths. Sociopaths are interesting. Sociopaths, most CEOs of large companies possibly are sociopaths, according to a study. Maybe not 100%, certainly not 100%, but people who rise to political power, corporate power, generals in the army, things like that, tend to be sociopaths. But sociopaths, it's a complex definition. It's one that is still debated, I think. But sociopaths are more within society, you see. They are able to do things and not worry about consequences to society. Would you say that might be correct?
Yeah, that sounds right. I'm going to trust your judgment on this one.
Okay.
Your knowledge.
Well, I mean, sociopaths are more in a social or society venue, okay? Psychopaths are more with the personality or the psyche, okay? They're more interested in the individual victim, okay? Whereas sociopaths, like, you might have a CEO of a company that's raping the rainforest for profit. He really doesn't care about the environment because he figures there's plenty of rainforest there that'll do just fine anyway. I mean, yeah, that kind of justification. But they don't feel the bigger social responsibility. But they're not, like, going person to person doing what the psychopath is doing, you see.
Right.
It's not personal. It's more on society.
That's a really great overview. Hopefully you can write
that down. Well, I've read a lot of articles on this. And they're actually, I mean, when I say most, it may not even be over 50%, but there is a higher than normal percentage of sociopaths at head of corporations, head of governments, head of military things. And that's because in some ways those qualities help you get to that level, you see.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It really does.
And it's like it's a position of power. And
exactly.
I think it was Robert Hare, the guy who wrote Without Conscience, Dr. Robert Hare, and he said if I wasn't in prison studying psychopaths and sociopaths, I would be on Wall Street and Washington, D.C.
Exactly, yeah. It's not a criticism of sociopaths either. I mean, this is just an observation, and it's not my observation. It comes from my readings. I mean, these are studies that I've looked at. So, and it's not actually my opinion, but I think that it could be. I mean, I think I can see where people who have, this is what I would say, people who have lessons in power and abuse of power will automatically rise to positions of power so that they can, you know, play out those spiritual lessons. You see?
Absolutely.
If you come into this life learning not to abuse power, then you have to be put in a position of power in order to have that test. That's all. And so a lot of sociopaths are involved in those kind of spiritual lessons. And you know, they may actually develop conscience, you know, if they are able to. You know, I mean, I think some people are right in the middle. You know, they're between having a conscience and not having a conscience, and they may be able to develop one, you know, to have some spiritual aha moments in their dealings as CEO of a major company, you know.
Yeah.
But in any case,
I think that's really a fascinating perspective on that. That's great.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I learned that in the military. I was in the military, and when I, actually for 13 years, and I saw the people getting promoted, they weren't the people that were competent. They were the people that were incompetent.
Yeah.
I mean, really incompetent, not a little bit. The general in charge of our hospital got court-martialed, you know, for abuse of power issues. You know, I mean, the people, I had really, really good doctors all around me that were Air Force Academy graduates. They were fabulous doctors. They were fabulous military people. And they were passed over for promotion. And the people being promoted, and then so I asked about it. I was doing spiritual work. And I asked about it, and what I heard was, well, because they don't have abuse of power lessons, they're not going to be promoted, and they'll go back out and go into, you know, they'll, when their time is up, they'll just become doctors on the outside, which is what happened, and leaving the people in the military with the abuse of power issues to go to the top to be tested.
Yeah.
And I said,
really,
oh, isn't that interesting? You know?
Like, yeah. And I mean, it goes back to that old paradox of that the people that most of us would actually want to see in power are not attracted to power. And so, it's a very
so what do you think of the presidential debate?
Oh, my God. I shouldn't say anything.
You think that principle might actually be true?
Yeah.
I mean, you look around and you see, where are the competent politicians, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the people running
people
for...
You can see, like, disorder.
A fair number of the
rampant
people running for office don't have the experience necessary to do the job, or don't have all of the experience necessary, you know. I mean, they're not coming, but and some people think that that's a good thing, you know, because they're not in the system. But in any case, we really do have, if you look at the earth plane as the place where you come to do these spiritual lessons rather than the place you come to do a competent job, then it makes more sense.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's my idea of sociopaths. And then, of course, on Wall Street, I mean, Wall Street is filled with sociopaths. I mean, that's you almost have to be a sociopath to be a successful trader and hedge fund manager like is on Billions now.
Yeah.
But, you know, and what's so interesting is the main character on Billions is actually not really a sociopath in all of his actions.
Yeah.
But, you know, he comes from a blue-collar work background, and he does have a lot of empathy for people who don't have as much as he does. You know, he's very generous. But then when he does that little thing with his friend, you know, his employee friend that has cancer, he has to question whether he's a sociopath, which is very, very interesting. You know, because he put his needs before the employee's needs.
But right, which is not
at least he had the ability to question, am I a sociopath? And I would say most sociopaths wouldn't have that ability. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah,
I mean,
that introspection is not there.
Yeah,
and it's also just like, you know, so many people think, like, gosh, like, if you just maybe go to therapy and dig into your childhood, you could figure out what's wrong and stop being like that. But you look at it like actually from the mindset of someone who believes that they're actually superior and better, that person isn't going to seek therapy. That's like, and maybe like you said, in that spiritual journey, eventually you realize that pervasive sense of up and then boredom and then up and then boredom isn't actually really happiness. But I mean, you can't force anyone to that point.
Well, psychopaths really look at every single relationship from the one viewpoint of what can I get out of this?
Yeah.
You know, it's sometimes it's emotional, sometimes it's physical, sometimes it's monetary, sometimes it's just having a slave do whatever you tell them to do.
It's just very parasitic.
Right. So they're not interested in any deep connection or love. I don't think that they've ever experienced love. But I wanted to talk a little bit about something you mentioned in the book, which I think is so true, is that psychopaths really project to everybody that they're a victim.
Yeah, there's a lot of pity plays there.
Where in actuality, they're the victimizer.
Yeah, it's basically, right. They'll tell you about things that have been done to them that they actually did to other people. You'll first hear about their crazy abusive ex who did all these things to them, cheated on them or lied to them, and all these things. And you'll soon come to discover that you are that person too. But those pity plays, I think, they really play to your sympathies and to your innate compassion. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, like when we think about a narcissist, for example, I think most people like watch Criminal Minds and they think, oh, I would never fall prey to someone who's like, you know, drives up in a flashy car and like dressed up in this fancy suit and gives me flowers and calls me babe and says I'm so amazing. Like, because most people wouldn't. That's like not really like an attractive thing. Whereas a lot of people, especially people who are just empathetic and I think more just in tune with people and their hearts and they like to make people happy, which is not at all mm-hmm. a bad quality. When they come across someone who seems like that wounded, hurt person who's never been happy before, and you're the first mm-hmm. person that actually made them feel happy, and they've never felt like this before, and you've saved them, it really plays to a totally different set of things where you don't really traditionally think of as flattery. But it certainly
yeah, it's
has
like
the same
a rescuer.
Effect.
Yeah. They rescued them. Yeah, that's very true. So one of the early signs would be if they try to make you feel sorry for them with these previous stories. It could be their childhood. It could be their, you know, the previous relationship. It could be whatever. But it's that they're trying to tell you that they were a victim of something.
Yeah.
And that somehow you can make them better.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the thing is that either way, those stories, they're one of two things. It's someone, in this case, using those stories to manipulate you, or it's someone who's genuinely in pain and still should probably work through it. And so no matter what, it may not be something that you really need in a relationship. Like, I know a lot of folks on our forum, and myself included, I went through this of you can't get out of what happened, and you still feel so bad and all that, so you try dating, and you're just a mess. You're a disaster. All you can talk about is this awful thing that happened to you. And mm-hmm. you're not like some bad person who's using it to manipulate, but like you got to be able to heal from those things before you can go on to another relationship. And that really can take a lot of time. So either way, definitely something to look out for.
Well, you know, a lot of times that when somebody hurts you, and it can be a sociopath or it can be a regular relationship that didn't work out, you have to dig deep within yourself to understand that you love yourself enough.
Yeah.
And not narcissistic
Absolutely.
Love, but true love. Your soul loves your this portion of your soul enough that it won't allow anybody else to hurt you. In other words, it is not acceptable to be hurt because you love yourself enough to come right out of it. And then once you're able to do that, it's kind of interesting because then after that, really nobody can hurt you. It doesn't exist anymore. Once you find that connection to your soul, you cannot be hurt.
I love this stuff that you're saying. This is the most fun interview I've had. I think one of the best lessons. I'm still honestly, like, I'm kind of figuring this out. So I take a while to figure stuff out, and at my own pace. I've been working on a lot of this lately too, of just like, yeah, we can build this world where, oh, there's other people that may harm us, and we need to protect ourselves. We need to armor our hearts and not be, you know, not let ourselves get hurt again. But I think you're absolutely right, is that if we can really like dig deep from this experience. And for me, it's I'm starting to see it more as this lesson instead of this, like, devastating, life-ruining thing. Because obviously, like, life turned out fine. But, like, there's this part where you're just, you realize, like, you don't need to live in a constant state of guarding and armoring and who might hurt you, who might do such and
right.
such. I think you're absolutely right that if you have that sense of, no, I love myself and I love my heart and my soul and I will make sure that my needs are met. There's probably a high mm-hmm. likelihood that you're not going to attract that kind of person anyways.
Right.
Because
you have spiritual protection.
Yeah,
exactly. Once you make the connection to your higher self and that connection stays open, you have a spiritual connection, a spiritual protection that will make sure that you'll recognize it when it comes close to you again in time before you fall in love again or anything like that. So that's all. You just have to realize that you really do have the ability to nurture that connection. And, you know, in your book you talk about meditation, you talk about other spiritual practices. That's the point of getting in touch with that higher part of yourself that can provide this protection. And so the only reason this happens to people is to get them to a place where they are open to doing these spiritual connections, because that's just one of many benefits once you have that spiritual connection. And I think psychopaths are drawn to people who are ripe for this. I think, you know, you say they're good people, they have consciences, they have, you know, emotional connections, ability, but maybe they just haven't had a crisis in their life. You know, and I'm talking like the death of a child would be a crisis. A relationship with a psychopath would be a crisis. You know, losing everything in a house fire with no insurance would be a crisis. You know, it takes something like that to really spur spiritual growth, because the degree of pain is so high.
Pain is where so much can become, like, get born from. That's such a great point. I know that I had never personally really, I was lucky enough to come from a happy childhood and mostly things were fine. I had, like, my own personal things I was going through. I had just actually come out of the closet right before I met my first boyfriend, who was this person. You know, we can run along in life with not having been hugely challenged like that. And I don't know. It's easy enough to look back and think, I wish I had just known all the things that I know now and felt all the things that I felt now back then. But the fact is, the only reason I can say that is because these things actually happened. Who knows where life goes when you're not challenged and when you don't have those opportunities for growth?
Well, I think we come in to have certain challenges presented before us. And I think that dealing with a psychopath in the kind of relationship you did is a real learning experience. There's no question about it. And I had a brief encounter with a psychopath that didn't turn out like yours did, because I had one of the things he said to me, which was interesting, he says, "I cannot believe how strong you are." And I said, "I was the first female plastic surgeon doctor through the military. You have no friggin' clue how strong I am." Okay.
That's awesome.
Those are my exact words to him. Like, I was the first female to break through that barrier in the military. You don't know. Okay. You don't know what I can do emotionally. So his tricks didn't work on me at all. Not at all. You know,
there was not even a remote sense of that getting what
he
wanted.
But I can see that if I didn't have the strength that I do emotionally. And I had it, by the way, because a previous boyfriend broke up with me. He wasn't a psychopath at all. He just broke up with me. I became depressed, not seriously, but, you know, enough that I didn't like it. And then I had that shift where I said, nobody is ever going to hurt me again. And then nobody did. You know, it was like I went through that shift with a non-psychopath. And then when a psychopath came into my life, I just, you know, I was okay.
Yeah.
But I can see if you didn't have that, how how it could really destroy you. Because he tried all those tricks that you talk about.
Yeah, that's really
they just didn't work, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, when he flattered me, people can't flatter me. I just don't flatter, you know. Like, I'm real aware of my own faults, and I go, wait a minute, you know, this is not true.
Yeah,
so,
that's cool.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm not perfect, you know. I mean, I know that very well.
Yeah.
So, and I know that, by the way, because my higher self will tell me when I'm not being perfect, okay? I mean, it's not another person criticizing me. It's the higher aspect of me saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, you might not want to do that.
Yeah.
Which is what let's bring the conversation back to that. That is what psychopaths don't have, is a conscience or a higher self telling them what behavior is acceptable. I often thought that this particular person had a dark soul connection. I mean, they were very spiritual, but not in a good way.
Yeah, I mean, connected to something different.
Yeah, I remember, I'll tell you a little story. He had the garage door opener to my house, and when I decided to kick him out of the house, it was basically because the office that he worked out of was in my house. We had a video production company. And he would come in late at night and have to get in when I was sleeping. When I changed all the locks on the door, but I didn't want to change the garage door opener because you can change the little things on the box, right?
Yeah.
And so I changed the things on the box, and then he had his garage door opener. He opened it. He changed it, and then he opened the door, and it opened. I mean, think about that. Think about how many combinations there are. And then he looked at me. He says, you cannot keep me out of your house.
Oh, God, that's scary.
So, you know, I attracted a psychopath that actually had spiritual, probably from dark side, but spiritual gifts that were absolutely incredible. And that wasn't the only thing he did. He had, I mean, just amazing stuff. Like he could remote view. He could tell me what I was doing because he could go out of body and remote view. Okay.
Oh, that's so sketchy.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Oh, God. And this person isn't in your life anymore.
I'm sorry?
This person isn't in your life anymore in any capacity,
no.
I'm assuming. That's good.
No, he's actually in prison.
That's scary. Okay.
<That's>,
cool.
But anyway, I didn't put him there. But, well, he might not be in prison now, but anyway, I don't know where he is. But but I will tell you this. I am very thankful that I had the experiences that I had with him.
Yeah.
Because I learned so much.
Yeah.
And
I
think you'll probably say the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
It really opened my eyes to, because I actually thought before I met him that anybody with that degree of spiritual gifts would have to be good.
Right, and then it turned out that he had that spiritual gift, but was not at all, I mean, at least our version of good.
Not at all.
That's interesting. Can I ask you, because I know this comes up a lot on our forums, and it's something that I try to better understand, too, is that a lot of us, after these relationships, there's this sense of whatever it is, some people might call it like trauma or resentment or disconnection, whatever it is, though, I think it's pretty universal that there's the body almost in its own way puts up this, I would say it's like a temporary shield that, like, you've been so badly wounded and you have this sense somewhere underneath that, like, you are bad, that there's something wrong with you. And so whatever this temporary shield that comes up is, it works kind of, like, it can keep out, it can notice bad things, it can say, okay, this person seems to be acting sketchy. But I think what I at least started to experience was that it was not sufficient. It would kind of, like, grow and grow and grow to the point that it was more paranoia than anything else, and, like, just constant state of fear and, like, what could go wrong now, what could go wrong now. So it's something you said that I really liked, and I know a lot of folks on our forum would probably love to understand, is that you basically, it sounds like you don't need, when you have that sense of self-love, like, I wouldn't let someone treat me badly or do something badly because I love myself, But that armoring, that temporary armoring, doesn't need to be there anymore because you have that
exactly.
sense
it doesn't
of love.
Now.
So how do you go about building that? I mean, you mentioned, is that meditation? Is that something else? Like, how do you find that part of you that loves yourself and not in that narcissistic way, but just in a way that you love yourself and want what's best for you and want yourself to be joyful, just like you want other people that way?
Well, I believe it's actually a spiritual connection. It's a connection that is not only energetic, but is, you know, you're in it because there are always synchronicities. There's always a constant communication back and forth. Like you kind of get glimpses of things that you need to know about. Some of them are warnings. Some of them are just things that good things are going to happen, and then they do. But Carolyn Mace had an interesting, description of this process. She called it from being horizontal to going vertical, and vertical meaning that in communication with the higher aspects of yourself. She mm-hmm. says that when this is ready to happen, it's called waking up, is what it's called, waking up to your true nature. And she said that in order for this to happen, you either have to lose everything or you have to think you're going to lose everything. Now, I don't know if that's still true in this day and age, but certainly in the 90s and 80s, when a lot of people were waking up, that was true. And so you might go through a financial crisis, a relationship crisis, a health crisis, or all three, you know, right near each other. And then because you don't have a big social circle and you'd have a lot more time on your hands, maybe you're not working, you know, you're able to do a lot more spiritual practices like meditation, yoga, tai chi, yeah. qigong, you know, whatever you're attracted to, or even just walking in nature. I don't think you really have to do anything other than just shut up in terms of, you know, the monkey chatter in your mind and start receiving from higher levels. You know, but you do because you're in a different place. You're in a different, you're ready to become the student of higher teachings because you don't have the answers, you know. And
exactly.
Like when,
there's no more like problem solving because that's the most.
Right. You can't solve it at the third dimensional level. Right.
Right. Because it's not about like you said the monkey chatter, like, that's the thing is that the monkey, it'll try so hard to solve the problem. Like, why do I feel this way? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with everyone else? And all that stuff.
You
and
are overanalyzing
very
now.
Weird that the only thing, yeah, exactly. The only thing that shuts it up is when you just, at least for me, is when I just can, like, kind of watch that happen and be like, yikes. And then, but actually hold it more with that compassionate sense of, and feeling, I guess, like, feeling feelings instead of that, like, hyper-analysis mode. That it was new for me, that analysis mode, and it's been very difficult to let go of. It's, you know, it obviously helped as far as getting myself back on my feet after this encounter, but at some point, it's not really a tool that you need in everyday life every second.
Yeah, I think you're right. Einstein said that you can't solve any problem at the same level of consciousness that created it. So this is kind of, you know, like stepping up your game so that you have more resources at a higher level. Now, once you make those connections, you don't need that artificial armor. And that armor is interesting. That armor is actually thought forms and emotional things. If you could actually see your aura, you're actually putting up things in your energy field to block people from coming in.
Yeah.
I mean, they're actually there. But once you have the true protection that you're higher, I mean, the spiritual sight and hearing, literally being able to listen at a higher level so that you know when danger is around, then you know that you have the spiritual protection where things can't hurt you. And they don't. You know, a calmness comes over you in real dangerous situations. There's just nothing that can, you just know deep in your heart, it's like an inner knowing that you're protected. Even in a very dangerous situation, you feel no fear. That's how you know you're protected. You feel no fear. And so I would say that as long as you're feeling fear in a dangerous situation, you might not be protected. You know, I mean, the fear can take over and strip you of your spiritual protection. So basically, that is, I think all of these painful things that occur are actually put in our path deliberately to get our attention so that we will become more receptive for these higher connections to occur.
Interesting. Yeah, it makes it a lot easier with that perspective to stop resisting so much of what's
happening.
So
do you want to give the listening audience your contact information?
And anyone can find me on our website at psychopathfree.com. And that's where we have a contact form there. But if they want to reach me by email, I really rarely check my my book email. But it's peace, like P-E-A-C-E, at psychopathfree.com. That's just my username there. And people are more than welcome to reach out. They'll probably receive faster responses and attention, though, if they register a post on the forum where there's, like, I think there's, like, 500,000 people on it now, so it's just very, very busy, and lots of people are always around and happy to help. It's an incredibly kind community of people.
Jackson, would you like to give your contact information?
Yes. So my email address is peace, so peace at psychopathfree.com. I said that I don't check it very regularly, so I definitely recommend if anyone's going through a difficult time, if they resonated with anything we spoke about and they're looking for help or support, to just check out our website, psychopathfree.com. Registration, membership, posting, it's all 100% free. And there's a huge community there of like 500,000 posts and people that are always around and ready to help.
That's great. Well, congratulations on forming that forum for people to get help. That's a great thing to have come out of your personal experience.
Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. We're coming up to the end of our hour. We've been interviewing Jackson McKenzie on Psychopath Free and his website. Please check that out. Let me just see here. Next week, we are going to be interviewing Dimitri Moritis, Change Your Aura, Change Your Life. And then on the 7th, the new spiritual chakras and how to work with them, Elizabeth Joy. And then an interview we pre-recorded, Dr. Christian DeQuincy, who's a professor of philosophy, Blind Spots, 21 Good Reasons to Think Before Your Talk. So thank you very much for joining us. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show.